Well, we should all sit down for the next 50 minutes.
Yes, you should, because I might go on a bit. I'll say something about this book first, because it was a matter of contention. When I said I thought about a book, I mean, it's not another book, it's an expensive book. You've got far too many books, which is perfectly true. And I said, a book on woodwork tools. I thought you had enough of those in the last 40 years, tools of all things. But it does happen to be, in my view, the most serious scholarly book for 100 years, since the Holt Zapffe works of 1840s, which I also have, incidentally. And it's the calibre of it is illustrated by the fact that the foreword is written by no less than Joseph Needham, the Master of Cambridge College, a Fellow of the Royal Society, and himself a world authority on the technological achievements of the old Chinese civilization. So it is a valuable book, and also I particularly wanted to have it so that you could sign on the fly leaf in this way. And I should be particularly rewarded at flicking through the thing from time to time and seeing those signatures there. Well, I don't quite know where to start. I think this is far too generous. Mr. Davis has said things that I really can't think apply to me. I had a little gambit, not mine own. Are you sitting comfortably? I might go on a bit. I had a little gambit that was taken out of the archives, which went something like this. Unaccustomed as I am to public speaking, it is now incumbent upon me, etc. But as an old artilleryman, I found that I'd got to traverse that round through 180 degrees of bearing and rephrase it. Accustomed as I am to public speaking, I now find myself quite at a loss to find words adequate to express what I've heard said, as applying to me. I can possibly believe it, and I mustn't be rude enough to doubt the sincerity of the speakers. I also can't find words to rebut what has been said. But as I look round here and consider what has been said, I know that I can assert that a certain slick saying that Oscar Wilde passed on Shaw could not possibly apply to me, at least now. You remember that Shaw and Wilde were both born in the same city, Dublin, and in the same year, incidentally, 1856. And speaking of Shaw, on one occasion, Wilde said in his Wildean way, "Everybody likes him, and he hasn't a friend in the world." I don't think that is my condition at the present time. Now, I would like to say something about this venue here, because I was flattered to have various other suggestions made, and I would have liked them, I would have acceded to them. But it did seem to me that this hall of ours, which has seen this kind of gathering before, was the best place where a number of colleagues who might care to come would be most likely to gather, rather than at perhaps some other time and place. And I'm most charmed to find this gathering in which I'm being feted with Irene, for I am being feted here. F-E-T-E, I mean, feted, you know. I am being feted here, and I'm most charmed to find Miss Brooks with us, and Mr. and Mrs. Graham, my old and esteemed headmaster. And so now I stand here, where you shall all stand in the fullness of time, if you follow your usual avocations and cheat death, which please God. I have served under, worked with, or for, and sometimes against, 9 headmasters, 6 of them dead, and there's a thought, sir. I've done my 44 years in various types of schools, some of which won't be resuscitated. I began in the old pre-war elementary school, a good school, which Mr. Graham knew, and in fact where he himself served under a most admirable old, if I'm an old stager, that headmaster was an even more worthy old stager, and very kind to me he was. After the war, I found myself in a school that was trying to turn itself into secondary modern, and I went there because my innate loyalty, it was supposed to be kept for me. It was trying to turn itself into a secondary modern school after the Butler Act of 44, And then I came to a secondary modern school proper, which was the Grange. And then by the whirly gig of reorganisation and so on, which I didn't go into, I found myself in the grammar school, the old grammar school. And now, I mean, we're in the comprehensive. So that is a gamut that can't quite be achieved by, presumably, by anybody in the future. I need a prompt, actually.
I wasn't initiated.
Coming into the grammar school, I remember quite well how I was received, and I'm grateful for it. It was a friendly, but you know that studied detachment, which is a mark of Englishry. And I knew I had to, not exactly establish myself, but you know, the passage of time would see how I was estimated and evaluated. And I think this sort of judgment of oneself by one's peers is one of the most rewarding things in life, when it turns out to be favourable, of course. And I've no reason to have any doubts or feeling on that account, for which I'm very grateful. And I've got very happy memories and associations. I've always been a shop floor teacher, I call myself. I've no ambitions to go further up the hierarchy. I've sometimes wondered in the last year or two why I haven't, by the way. But I haven't had this. I've believed in this, you know, H.L. Mencken thing, ideal of education, where Mencken, the American writer, where he said Mark Adams, his favourite teacher, should be at one end of the old-fashioned school form, and he, you know, the expectant pupil, Mencken at the other, and this sort of quasi-Socratic dialogue going in between them, you know, the mature man drawing him out and so on. And this has been my simple ideal with the individual and with the group. How successful I've been, I don't know. But I've certainly had job satisfaction in the modern Kant phrase before that terminological inexactitude was invented by the current psychologists and, you know, personnel buddies. And I've enjoyed being in the workshop. It was a sidestep in a way, because I set out in life to become a mechanical engineer in the old way, where, well, I left school by 15 and a half, and I went through partly in the pattern shop and then in the drawing office, and that was the old way. As some people present here will know, you went in the works, and then you went to the technical college, and you worked pari passu in the evenings, and you hoped by the end of your 20s you might have those magic letters at the end of your name, associate member of the Institute of Mechanical Engineers, and so on. But I'd always been very attached to schools, so in particular, and I kept in touch with them, and I could never dissociate myself from school somehow. My coming into teaching was not a second best to me, it was a second first in a way, it was parallel. And of course I'd always have this workshop thing, having gone into workshops very a small boy with my father, belonged to an engineering family. And I had a little workshop of my own at home, and so on, and I had this sort of craft facility and interest, and so I've continued this and taught craft, but it's not been my only interest in life. And so I'm not going to say that that's life, as in the Esther Anson phrase, for instance. Although I might tell you that my daughter in the John Lewis partnership, having had one or two brushes with Esther Anson over the telephone business-wise, is not exactly enamoured of that sort of phrase. I don't want to enlarge on this. I've been happy, not all the time. The 44 years, I've wondered at times whether I'm ever going to get out of this, you know. But of course, I am liberated at last, in a sense. If you ask me what I'm going to do, well, I'm going to do everything, you know. I shall fall flat on my face with lots of things. I shan't be able to do everything. I shan't have the capacity. I shan't have the brains. Although I'll interpolate a little story here. I once did try to get brains. I've told this story, and I'll repeat it because some won't know it. I did, at the age of 18, get into a lecture that was given by Einstein, because I was very starry-eyed about such people in my youth, and I was the youngest person there, and as he got out of the room, I got very close to him through the crowd and reverently touched him on the shoulder. Both shoulders, in fact. But when I told this story some little time ago, a wag who is not 100 yards from here or 100 miles said quickly, well, none of the genius seemed to rub off. That's perfectly true. I accept that. I'm not doing that. I'm just changing my life. It's a change of life style, if you like. I've had a private joke with the headmaster about this, and I can let it out. I'm undergoing a change of life style. I'm carrying on 101. I would finally, I don't go on too much, I would finally like to tell you a story, just one story, a perfectly true one, which I shall seek to prove. It's a shaggy dog story. My wife tells me that I get people lost and get some so discursive, but you must just put up with it a while. This will seek to prove that whatever I now am, dubious or doubtful or ambivalent or ambidextrous or, you know, generally disreputable, there was a time when I was quite innocent. It was a time about the end of the 1920s, the time of the flapper boat, Mr. Davies, and very short skirt, you know, the flapper. Yes, they were there in those days. I was, say, 17, and I used to go to an institution for evening classes myself in diversity of subjects, even French, which I was never good, and machine construction and drawing, and even in organic chemistry and things like that. But I used to help at class because there were two particular teachers there to whom I owe a lot. One, a younger man, a man of parts, who became a university lecturer, then an HMI. As far as I know, he is still living in his, you know, down in Epsom to this day. The other's an older man. And I used to go and help them with classes. And I wasn't attending the particular class I'm going to tell you about, but it was being disturbed on a particular night, this mathematics class, regularly on Tuesday night, by two girls who came and climbed on the railings and chai-hiked either the teacher or somebody in the class, a boyfriend. And this got to be a nuisance. Now, I describe the school a bit, because it was rather similar to this building, having been designed by the same architect, George H. Widows, who retired in 1935, and I met him very briefly in 1934. I met him very briefly in 1934 when he came to a school where I was introduced by the headmaster. So that's that. I've got a contact with the architect of this school, which opened in 1910. How's that for history? Well, anyway, I mustn't get you lost. The nature of the building was such it had a shrubbery along the front, as it might be there, and a low wall with railings on it, as this had until the war, and bushes, and about 7 or 8 feet of classroom windows. And the feet of the school were two long corridors, which ran parallel 50 or 60 yards apart, and they bushed out onto this shrubbery at right angles through portico doors, a bit like the end of this corridor. You see, same architecture, you know, a bit more modest, but similar doors, and then up onto the road. And it was a narrow road that went nowhere, and there were railings on the other side, so that was inaccessible. And an obvious plan of campaign, you see, two corridors, two doorways, perfect military ambush. People go down there, like beat it at one end, alarm the birds, and they run one way. You see, this is precisely what happened. But I didn't see that these two teachers chose to go one way, and the older man, who always called me Joff, never Jeff, Joff, he was a man of the Arnold Bennett country, Bursley, so that might account for it. He said, "Jock, we go there." And of course, I went there, always being willing to help and ready and, you know, quick. So, of course, these girls started. They were disturbed. They came running down the road. One shoved me out and got right by him, but the other really got hold of Buxom, she was. I remember distinctly. My first real contact with filly flesh, really. And she pummeled my face, scratched it even, as they do, you know. And, "Let me go, you fool, let me go, you fool." And I hadn't been briefed for this. I didn't rumble at these two chaps had stopped up the road, and they knew what they were doing. There was a gas lamp, and I could see them through this gas lamp. They knew what they were doing, all right. They'd set it up. And I wasn't briefed, I didn't know. I called out, "I've got her, I've got her. What shall I do with her now?" So I really was rather innocent at that time. Well, I only want to say one thing. Well, perhaps two, because I'm very sensible. No, I'm very sensible how this function is done so beautifully every time. I do want to thank all our colleagues who are responsible for it. Really thank them truly. And I do finally want to thank you all for the last time. Really thank you with the deepest warmth for seeing me with Irene, seeing me off in this very splendid fashion.